All right, recorder's turned on. All right, so we've really got two topics for today. One of them is artificial intelligence, and one is virtual reality. And I thought we'd do them at least initially one at a time. So let's start with artificial intelligence. And as usual, let me start with what you want to talk about, and then go on to a few things I might want to talk about. So are there things in, yeah?
I didn't really follow how you can make a digital sort of copy of yourself.
Uploading, yes.
Yeah.
What's puzzling about it?
You diverge immediately. It could be a snapshot of you at that point.
That's right. But that's what it would be. So just as the me that exists in this body could follow a variety of different paths hereafter, I could decide in another year to retire and spend all my time blogging and writing novels and doing other playing with my grandkids and things. Or I could decide, no, I want a new career. I'm going to become a constitutional theorist or something. Probably not a constitutional theorist, but get involved in some other area of the law. Those are different paths. Those are different me's. They're both me. Right? So similarly, if uploading works, we end up with a programmed computer, which up to the point when we uploaded was me. It's got my memories. It's got my ways of thinking, my approach to the world, and it's then going to diverge. And it'll probably diverge faster because the programmed computer, once it's there, is going to be more different from me than the different possible futures I could follow are. So I'm not sure what the puzzle is.
So I got that part. I must have just read about, to the extent that it's going to be sort of a standard for you.
Well, the legal issues arise if you upload after you acquire some legal obligation, or if you imagine copying it. So we upload it. It then does things. Unfortunately, it turns out when I'm in software that I'm less scrupulous than I thought I was. Maybe it was sort of, the biological body and its guilt hormones or something that was keeping me honest. And so the uploaded version of me thinks I'm a really clever con and cheats somebody out of $15 million. It then copies itself. Which copy is now liable for that crime? All right. If you arrest one copy, is the other copy now home free? All right. So the real sort of the underlying point is that if we have human level AIs, in one sense they'll be people just like us, and in another sense they will be people radically unlike us. And one of the radically unlike things is that computer programs are easy to copy. All right? So that's one of the respects. And that's going to raise a bunch of interesting issues, but some of them which I tried to suggest. Other? Yeah.
So, step it up thinking about what if our, perception of consciousness, this very limited, we start thinking, okay, in this situation, we have a duplicate of ourselves, or a separate consciousness. But maybe what if we don't understand our consciousness as well? What if you could have duplicates of yourself? And running, say this morning you wanted to do 10 different things, but you can only do one thing for your person. Yes. What if you could actually share your memories of these multiple consciousnesses that are going on and experience all those things at the same time? So do 10 days of the stuff in one day, have a 10
day. So there are two different questions here. One of them is, can I have 10 identical ones of me doing 10 things? And the answer in principle is sure. If we can upload, I upload 9 copies and set one to each.
Yeah.
But the other is, can I be all of them thereafter? And I don't see how uploading is going to do that.
Right now, when you think of, it's so abstract that you think, okay, once you upload it, it'll be a separate consciousness.
So what you want to do is to have a 10-headed me, which is somehow in full communication. Yes, right. But, right. Now, I'm not sure that's impossible, but it seems to me that's going to be a different problem than uploading. Because the uploaded me has still got only my intelligence, my information handling abilities might be fast, but, so, my existing version, I have enough trouble already multitasking. All right. I have observed, mostly playing World of Warcraft, that my kids are much better at multitasking than I am. That My daughter, as far as I can tell, can simultaneously do a competent job of playing World of Warcraft and conduct three different online conversations with three different people, type it, and it doesn't need to bother her.
So the limitations is really just
our bodies. It doesn't have to be the body, it can be the mind. That's a mental limitation.
But
so
that's based off our physical body, but on the virtual sense.
But the uploaded version, as long as all we're doing is uploading, it's an exact copy of my mind. It might run faster, but so it's an exact copy of my mind, and my own mind is only good at paying attention to one thing at a time.
But why? Well, maybe that is the thing that we are only considering because of our, that's what we know is consciousness being, is one focus, ability to focus on one thing, or
yes,
multitasking, or ability to focus on one thing.
But once you change that ability, it seems to me that's got to require not merely a copy of me, but an improved version of me. That fits, excuse me, that what that's fitting with is not the uploading model. That's fitting with Kurzweil's idea of our all becoming computers.
Yeah.
Right? Kurzweil has this sort of very clever idea, which is that you've got this dreadful future you can imagine where we stay what we are and the computers get smarter and smarter, and pretty soon, as I say somewhere in the book, we're gerbils. All right? They're so much smarter than we are that they control the world. And I don't know if any of you have read the science fiction series I mentioned, which is not one I'm particularly fond of, but the culture novels by Banks. But in that one, you've got these gigantic spaceships, which are basically very smart AIs, and they're really running everything. And they're human-like creatures who they carry around with them, and I guess they like them. But anyway, that's one future. And Kurzweil's response to that is, aha, the way out is not to hobble the AIs, but to increase us. And so he says, if only we knew enough to do this sort of stuff, we then have fast mind-to-machine links. And I'm sitting here with this brain in here and this brain in my pocket. I do it already, after all, because, my phone numbers are not up here. They're down here. But if I could communicate with my silicon brain at silicon speeds, as it were, then my IQ goes up and up and up, and I can devote part of that to paying attention to this. And then it seems to me that your world becomes possible. But then the way we do your world, I think, is not I have 10 copies of me, but I have one copy of me, and one of the things it's doing is telecontrolling a machine over there doing that, and another thing it's doing is mind-to-machine typing out the novel I'm working on, and another, so it seems to me that the story you're now telling is really a story about expanding human abilities, not about uploading.
Yeah.
And that they're both interesting stories, but they're not the same story.
Right.
Make sense? Yeah. The other people? Other comments? Yep.
I think going off the kind of multiple versions of you doing the same thing that I'm sharing with you later, why not do it? There's no reason you can do that. You couldn't do that with different people. It wouldn't have to be a copy of the subject or something. We'd have one in this room, but all upload them, we'd all share the same memories.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know enough about how memories work, but I agree. It is at least logically possible that you could have a situation where human beings had some way, once we understood how the mind worked, of pooling memories. And that's interesting from a bunch of different ways. For one thing, you might argue that would give you an alternative to education. That after all, when I pool with the memory of somebody who's French, now I speak French fluently, maybe. And that's an idea that obviously has appealed to people for a long time. Whether it's workable, we don't know. But you could also imagine, going back to your thing, you could imagine that I upload a bunch of copies, and that somehow after the copies all do their different things, they can then copy over the memories of each of them, so each of them has all the memories. Right? That would be an imaginable arrangement, and only by that time we understand how memories are stored. Now, of course, one of the questions in all of these things is at what point it's still you? So if you imagine, I mean, that's part of the Kurzweil puzzle, that am I defined by continuity? And I think I am, and the reason I think I am is that I've interacted with old people whose minds were largely gone, and they still feel to me like the same person. All right. If you think about someone suffering from fairly serious Alzheimer's, at least as I perceive it, and it doesn't seem to me it's just what the face looks like. My gut level feeling is there's a personality in there. That's the person who I knew for a long time, but unfortunately, is got serious problems now. And if that's right, then that would suggest that if I get smarter and smarter, I'll still be me. I'll just be. So, but we don't. I don't know if anybody really knows what identity is. You know, we've got sort of gut level intuitions about it. I don't know how much beyond that.
The other people's comments on the AI stuff. Yeah.
I had a question. Oh, so on.
Not on the AI.
I just thought the conclusion about the fact that perhaps we might not be able to replicate human level intelligence because, and I think this goes back to what you were saying, that because initiative and purpose drive so much of what we do, and you have to think that if you create an artificial intelligence that has our capabilities, that it would have to be able to make purpose for itself, otherwise it's just
right.
A slave.
Yep.
Maybe initiative and purpose can also be driven by hormones. Maybe
by what?
Hormones.
But we can have synthetic, we can have the equivalent of hormones. All you have to do is to say, how does the hormone influence the mind? Now model that in our computer mind and do the same thing, right? So, and there's a lot of stuff we don't really understand about ourselves. And we've got guesses. Think about the question of where our moral beliefs come from. All right? Why is it that it seems obvious to me that torturing children to death is a bad thing to do? It's not like I can derive it from the facts of reality. And not only do I believe it, everybody I know believes it. And maybe that's hardwired in. Maybe the answer is that ancestral humans that didn't have certain beliefs, true or false, built into them, weren't able to survive. They didn't have the incentive to take care of their children. And you can think of lots of other things that, as I may have commented before, my current theory about why people believe in the immortality of the soul with no particular evidence is that one of the things hardwired into our perception of reality is continuity, is the fact that if I see this pen here, aha, same pen down there. Not, there was a pattern of red dots here, now I see a pattern of red dots here, now my software has got to refigure out what it is. All right, so one of the facts of reality that I think is hardwired into our perception. I don't know if any of you have thought about how impossible what we do all the time is in terms of seeing. If you imagine trying to write a computer program which will take the input to my retina and say, that is the nose of a person. That part of white is the apple pattern on the back of a MacBook. That red over there is, I don't know what, looks like a ribbon hanging out of the ceiling. That's not what my eye is seeing. What my eye is seeing is red, beige, you know, a bunch of different colors. And somehow you've got to do quite a phenomenal amount of processing to get from a visual field to what actually all of us have, which is a picture of our actual environment. All right? What's coming through to me is not... I don't see your black hair and that black chair as just two different patterns of black. Your black hair is the hair of a person, and that's what I'm seeing. That's the back of a chair. So there's a whole lot of processing going on. And my understanding is that when AI people started trying to teach computers to see, they discovered it was a whole lot harder than they expected for those reasons. So almost certainly what's going on, I think, is that evolution is hardwired into us. A bunch of facts about deducing the world from the visual field. Most of which are true, not all of them necessarily. Some of them may be just mostly true. That when optical illusions fool us, it's because they're taking advantage of a situation where those facts aren't true. And one of the facts is continuity. One of the facts is you don't have to recalculate every time, if you imagine sort of like a 60 frame a second movie, you don't have to recalculate the universe every time. You rather have a picture of the universe, and the universe consists of things, and things move continuously around. And that's why soap bubbles are amazing. Because soap bubbles break the rules. They just, poof, it's not there anymore. Well, if that's right, one of the things that I perceive in the world is the personality of other human beings. It's one of the really important things that matters a lot to us. So, therefore, if such and such a person existed a second ago, he must exist now. Not quite sure where he is. Huh. Body isn't moving anymore. It must be somewhere else. So, seemingly, that's at least a plausible guess as to why we have a strong intuition about immortality. I'm not saying whether the evolution is true or not. Unfortunately, I'm afraid it isn't, although I'd like to believe it is. But as the alternative guess is wishful thinking, and that strikes me as less plausible. I didn't wish, people who did wishful thinking wouldn't have been men in hell, right? Anyway, somebody want to say something? Yes.
I thought that was interesting because I think I remember reading a long time ago when I was like volunteering in a hospital that I guess children aren't, babies aren't born with like hardwired with this, the concept of continuum. Either it's something that is developmental and physiological, yep. So it is hardwired to some degree,
yes.
It has to develop, or it's something that has to be externally programmed.
Yes.
And so that's why the concept of peekaboo is like so exciting,
right,
to them when something, when they're so young and something goes away.
It's not immediately obvious to them there's something is hidden that's still there.
Yeah, in their mind it goes away forever, which is why, you know, they,
yes,
cry when a mother leaves, because to them at that, yeah, stage it's forever.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah, no, my, well, yeah, no, whether hardwired, I mean, obviously the DNA has only got so much in it, so that hardwired could easily mean a design such that as your brain develops, certain things become true of it. But anyway, so those things. So one of the questions is, if you make AIs, what do you hardwire? What facts of reality are you going to hardwire into them? And maybe the solution to keeping them loyal to us is that just as it's hardwired into me that you shouldn't torture small children, it will be hardwired into the AI I write that you should do things for the benefit of human beings. This gets you to Asimov's three laws of robotics for those of you who are science fiction fans. And of course, Asimov had a lot of fun in his stories with seeing ways in which it could go wrong, in which the problem of how if you tell a robot that you are not allowed to injure a human being, but you're not obligated to spend all your time protecting human beings, so it takes a big heavy rock, lifts it above you, lets go, saying to itself, I can always catch it, so I'm not injuring the person. But now that the rock is falling, I'm not obliged to catch it. So that's the way in which a robot that wanted to kill you could kill you without violating that version of the three laws. So all I'm saying is it trying to figure out how to program something of human-level intelligence in such a way that it would end up doing the things we wanted it to do might well be a non-trivial and dangerous project. Other people? Comments? Yes?
The neural net, he's using that as kind of a... That's his term for parallel computing, essentially, within the mind, or is it that, like, I wasn't exactly clear on what the neural net is?
Yes, I think a neural net is a form of computer which is not the CPU, do this. And I'm not really enough of an expert on computer science to tell you in much detail, but I think it involves a very interconnected system where the programming goes by the strength and weakness of the connections. So I think the way they do some of the stuff like face recognition is that you set up, you know, a bunch of nodes connected to each other in various ways, which I guess is more or less what the brain is, and you then sort of randomly modify it, select out the ones that do a better job of identifying faces, and keep going that way.
What I found really interesting about his discussion about that was that ultimately you wind up with the same problem where with computers without neural net, you were able to set one up the same way. You aren't exactly sure how you identify that as a ribbon or everything else, and so now that computer can't go back and tell you how it did it.
That's right.
This is all kind of stuff.
Yes, but it's surely true of an awful... And one of the things that struck me a long time ago is when I was a kid, I played ping pong with my father in the basement. We had a ping pong table in the basement. And I should say, if any of you are interacting with kids, let me recommend, if you want to play a competitive game with kids, the way to do it is not to cheat. It's to have a sliding handicap. Right? There are two approaches to playing games with kids. One of them is you play chess with the kid and you deliberately play badly. And I don't approve of that. That's dishonest. The other way is you play chess with a kid and you say to the kid, all right, because I'm a grown-up and you're a kid and you don't know this game very well, we're going to start that I don't have a king or one of the castles. And then if you still win, the next time you start out without either castle and you keep going that way. And the way we did ping pong on that principle, basically, I started with a certain number. You're playing 21 points. I start with a certain number of points. Every time I win the game, my starting number of points goes down by one. Every time I lose, it goes up by one. So I've got the continual challenge of, can I push my handicap down? But every game is competitive and fun. that's a long digression. It's just useful if any of you are parents, because I have strong views on this subject. But what I was going to say is, it occurred to me at some point much later that I could watch, I should say I eventually pushed the handicap to zero, but by that time I was a high school junior or something, and that I could watch somebody play ping pong and say, isn't it amazing that a human being can do that? I don't know if you've played ping pong, but look, you've got almost no time, you're hitting this ball, you've got a tiny angle that you've got to put it into in order to get over the net and still hit the table. But it was somebody who I could beat. So that there was a human skill which I had at least as high a level, and I couldn't understand how people could do it. And that sort of struck me as an interesting case of you don't really know how your own mind functions. That you know sort of a top level of it that you can follow. But there's a whole lot of stuff below that which you can't follow and don't know. And hopefully we'll know more about that stuff by the time we're building human level AIs, because that's somewhere you have to figure out. Book I recommend to people, I would recommend it before or not, called Thinking Fast and Slow. It's by a psychologist who got a Nobel Prize in Economics, which is something of an accomplishment. And it's basically about how the human mind works. In particular, why we make the mistakes we make. And his underlying thesis is that you can model the human mind as two systems. One of them is the fast mind and one of them is the slow mind. The slow mind is conscious thought, and the fast mind is what does almost all of the work. So that when I look around and recognize a person, that's the fast mind. I don't say, well, he is this tall, those are his eye colors, ha, let's deduce who he is. And what's going on is the fast mind is running in the background, it's doing almost all of the work, and it's not very smart. It can't be very smart because it's got to be fast, and therefore it uses all sorts of rules of thumb. And therefore, you can, in some cases, predict human mistakes by what those rules of thumb will be. So it's thinking fast and slow, I recommend it highly. And to take one example, the fast mind is very bad at probability theory. And it, roughly speaking, classifies things as impossible, possible, or certain. And the result is that if you imagine, this is partly an explanation of what economists call the lottery insurance puzzle. Why is it that people both are willing to buy lotteries, at which point you are on average paying a price in order to get a risky outcome, and buy insurance in which you're paying a price in order to eliminate a risky outcome? And his explanation is that the way your fast mind is seeing it is that the lottery moves a very attractive outcome from zero, from impossible to possible. The insurance moves a very unattractive outcome, having your house burned down and not being able to replace it, from possible to impossible. And that those discontinuous changes look bigger than the real probability changes. So it turns out that people will value reducing a risk from 10% to zero by much more than they will value reducing it from 80% to 70%. And so, anyway, so it's quite an interesting attempt by. Yep.
So, you think that people make decisions just based on their fast mind?
Except you shift it to the slow mind when the slow mind decides there's some reason why it's important enough for the fast mind will have to do it.
So that's a different lot of people. Some people just make decisions.
Everybody's using both. At least in his model, everyone is using both. The problem is that the slow mind is a scarce resource. You can't afford, you don't have the time and attention to devote the slow mind to solving all problems. So part of what the slow mind is doing is selecting out from all the things you're doing which ones it'll pay attention to. And he's got sort of quite, part of the fun of the book, I should say, is that he makes the reader an experimental subject. So that there are a whole bunch of places where he gives you some puzzle and asks you to answer it. And typically, either you immediately come up with the wrong answer and then think about it and see the right answer, or you just come up with the wrong answer. And he then explains why. Anyway, that could be a longer discussion. But it's quite a fun book. That was our Christmas book this year, meaning it's the book that we gave as a Christmas present to friends. So we did another good idea. The funny thing was that somebody also gave it to me as a Christmas present, not knowing I had read it. So. Which was a good judgment, I suppose. Just a little late. All right, so Other comments on AI? Yes.
I just found interesting also the potential where they're discussing that some $3.7 trillion in funds are being invested essentially according to these algorithms that predict markets, and that this has the potential to blow, like, absorb the entire market, and then what you're left with now is you're not necessarily betting on individual stocks, but betting on individual algorithms almost, and so it just changes the market. I just found that really interesting, that discussion.
As you may know, there is one standard gambling game on which the house cut is negative if you pull, because you play perfectly, and that's blackjack. And the person who discovered that then, I gather, it was a mathematician, then went on to do a firm that engaged in very sophisticated stock trading, stock and other securities trading, was referred to as statistical arbitrage. This literal arbitrage is where you have a set of transactions such that combined they have to make a profit. So if you imagine that you've got three different things, say three different currencies, and there's an exchange rate from dollars to yen, yen to pounds, and pounds to dollars. If those rates aren't consistent, there is some set of trades which makes you a net gain. All right, if you can get more dollars by trading dollars to yen to pounds to dollars than you start with, and if the rates aren't consistent with each other, then one way or the other around that circle you can. And statistical arbitrage is the equivalent, except that you're not, it isn't really certain, it's rather a set of gambles that have that characteristic. Beat the House, I think, was the name of the book where he originally explained how to play blackjack. And the casinos did various things to make it harder, of course, for sensible people, including identifying the small number of people who are really good at this and not letting them play. But anyway, that's... Yeah, no, one of the other interesting features is that once you've got your computers doing trading, the fact that I can do my trading in a hundredth of a second faster than you can means that if a profitable opportunity appears, I get it and you don't. And apparently one result is that people in this business are willing to pay quite high prices in order to have very, very fast communication channels to basically put in fiber optic lines to places in order to save, you know, a thousandth of a second kind of thing, which seems a bit wasteful, but it's sort of an interesting feature of that situation. Yep.
Oh, I was going to say... Actually, my boyfriend did that for a living, designed the algorithms for computer generating. And,
For trading?
Yeah, for trading. And then now he works in market making, which likewise takes off that second difference when you're placing trades as well. But I also worked on the sell side, so I kind of saw the human error when essentially, you know, things can go out of flux just due to the fact that we're making decisions that aren't necessarily equal. They're not rationally based either. So that's always like the counter argument that I would make in support of the fact that algorithms are, you know.
Well, but depending on how there's an algorithm which is finding true arbitrage doesn't depend on people being rational.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that they're trying to do. Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. Kahneman is the author of the book. I was just trying to remember that. I was mentioning it took a while for my fast mind to dredge it up. But there's an interesting question of whether what he's doing is a critique of economics or an expansion of economics. Because economics, as I understand it, is based on the assumption that individuals are rational. That the best way of predicting people's behavior is to say they will take the actions that best achieve their ends. And Kahneman is explaining irrationality. But you could say, no, he's explaining rationality one step up, because since your slow mind is a scarce resource, just as it isn't rational to put the most expensive high-test gasoline in a car where it makes no difference, so it isn't rational to use your slow mind to get the right answer if a fast mind can get an almost right answer and you've got other things you've got to do with the slow mind. So that's sort of an interesting question of whether he's an economist or an anti-economist, as it were. But anyway, it's a fun book. But going back for a moment to the trading, one of the reasons why I believe that if AI is doing, it's going to happen, is that that's one of the places where it could make a great deal of money. That if you think about having the market watched by something of human-level intelligence that thinks 10,000 times as fast as we do, and perhaps has much more than human-level memory capacity, My guess is that could make an awful lot of money. And that, yeah.
Are you familiar with Watson, the computer?
I don't think so. Which one is this?
It was like a year ago. I think it was Intel or HP built this computer.
IBM.
Yeah. And it went up against like the best players in Jeopardy and just crushed it, like obliterated them. And it was apparently way smarter. Like,
I would have said though that Jeopardy is a pretty poor test because Jeopardy surely is mostly memorizing things, isn't it?
What?
I've never played it, so.
I mean, I think so. Yeah.
So the mere fact, what?
It's not the challenge was that.
What?
The challenge was the computer didn't know the what questions would be given, so it was connected to the internet. So, and the answer has to be in a question form. So not only did it have to understand what the person was saying, search the internet or wherever it was connected,
yes,
and form the right question. And then
yes. Yeah. No. That is the language understanding part is difficult, but that we can already. We all of us have solved that problem already. And the fact that it could win the game, it seems to me, is really a matter of it having access to much more data that the, in a sense, the equivalent would be if the human players had internet connections and lots of time to.
Well, no, they didn't have much time, right? Yeah. Because it
was going for the weather. Yeah, of course. But the fact that it can do, the fact that computers can do easy things very fast is not novel, right?
Well, doing that, I think the big issue is that when you do search algorithms, the problem is that the synonyms or the context is very hard to get. I mean, mm-hmm. You can get a keyword that, but without context, it could mean anything.
Yep.
We humans are very, very good at it.
And yes.
Tell me anything, I can take care of the meaning,
yep,
right meaning out of the context. Computer has a very difficult time doing that. And that's why you see Google search isn't contextualized that much. I mean,
yes.
But then where do you get this? And that's the difficulty. So one thing I, whatever I know there about the AI, that one thing I don't think anybody has thought is that machines cannot do causal relationships. It can only do correlation. They're very good at correlation. So you can put machine learning algorithms and do tremendous algorithm for correlation. But never can you have a machine actually put a causal model.
Why couldn't a machine deduce a causation just as a human does?
It can do best as, I don't know, but it can only do correlation. So
I don't understand why it can only
do time, for example, daytime, sun comes out, that's a correlation, not
yes.
a causation.
Yes.
Machine cannot deduce that there was daytime because the sun came out.
But you can't deduce it either just from that information. You presumably know various things about how the universe goes around from which it follows.
Well, I don't know if anybody has actually ever come up with a machine learning or any artificial intelligence method that actually can't use causation. Nobody has successfully done.
Well, we certainly know how scientists try to determine whether correlation is causation. Namely, by doing controlled experiments. That if you there's just been a bunch of stuff recently about some researchers at Harvard who claim that meat is bad for you, and some pretty good critical responses by people pointing out that that's correlation, not causation. That there are lots of alternative explanations, and at least one person who claims that these researchers at Harvard have an unbroken record of reporting, making causal claims that were then not confirmed by experiment. So
that humans cannot get the causation wrong, but there isn't a machine that actually.
But what I'm saying is, I don't see why you couldn't program a machine to first observe a correlation and then do experiments in order to test whether it was causation. So if we imagine that the machine observes a correlation between eating meat and getting cancer. And the machine then, assuming it's got the resources, which it doesn't, takes 10,000 people, 5,000 it feeds meat to, 5,000 it doesn't, it watches what happens. That's going to be a test for causation, the same test that human beings use now. So it would be, I don't see why it couldn't, in the same way, in principle, deduce causation. But
it'd have to actually then be able to design that experiment. And I'm
yes.
interested in a machine that can design experiments because then.
The programmer designs the general purpose experiment. The programmer tells it this is what you do to check whether your correlation is a causation. No.
If you bring in human intervention, then you're changing
But you're always bringing human invention at the beginning when you build it. The question is, once you build it, can it then do something? Yeah.
But to be fair to the machine, you were also taught the scientific method. It's not like you were born with it, right? So the machine would have to have been programmed. Same way you were taught in school.
I don't think my kids do a lot of production. I don't think they're scientists.
A lot of people don't have enough information. They make a lot of correlations, see a lot of correlation, and they make a guess on causation, if the guess is right. But then a computer can make just as good of a guess, but that's just how deep you go into, you know, criticize or analyze whether that causation is true. So whatever that means, when a child sees like, oh, sign goes up, sign goes down, he's not going to understand the whole model. He's going to get taught that in school, and then he's going to be like, okay, well,
I haven't seen anything that has helped a computer take the next step from correlation. A human does.
Don't know.
Let
me go on to a different topic in AI, which isn't in the book because I hadn't thought about it, but it's something some other smart people have thought about that interested me. And I want to go back back to about 1800. In economic theory, because there is an idea which in some form appears in Adam Smith, but then more clearly with Malthus and Ricardo, called the Iron Law of Wages. And the basic idea of the Iron Law of Wages, which turned out to be an incorrect prediction, although it made perfectly good logical sense, is that there is some wage level at which the working population just reproduces itself. And if wages go up, then workers find they can afford to marry earlier, they can afford to have more kids, they can feed their kids better so they're less likely to die, they can in various ways improve their condition, with the result that the population expands. All right? And then the argument is, if the population is expanding, more work, more labor for the same amount of capital, that's going to drive wages down. Or if you take Malthus's very famous version of this, what Malthus says is that the population is expanding exponentially. Eventually, that's going to run into real limits of how much food we can grow and things of that sort. And consequently, eventually that expansion will start driving wages down. So then the Iron Law of Wages says the long-term wage will always be the level that just maintains the population. And Ricardo, who is probably the smartest of that group of people, made it clear that this didn't mean subsistence. Because what the wage level is that will maintain the population depends on the tastes of the workers, on at what point they're willing to have more kids or fewer kids. So there's a wonderful passage in Ricardo where he says that the friends of mankind must wish that the working classes should have luxurious tastes. Because if they have luxurious tastes, then they'll only start having more babies once they're pretty well off, and then you'll have a long-term equilibrium if people are well off. It's quite an interesting idea. Malthus made a prediction, famous prediction, which turned out to be wrong, that Malthus was responding to some slightly earlier writers who had had a very rosy picture of the future. And they had described a future in which there was no want, essentially, in which people had everything they wanted. And Malthus said that is not possible. That's not a stable equilibrium, because Malthus says people like sex. He, at least in the original discussion, he doesn't really discuss contraception, which existed to some extent, but not very much then. People like sex. The only reason they're willing to restrain themselves from producing all the babies they can is that babies are expensive and they also don't want to be hungry. Therefore, if they had unlimited supplies, you would have reproduction at more or less the biological maximum, and that population increase would swamp any possible technological improvement and therefore drive things back. And that was the original. Malthus did not, in fact, predict that population increase will cause catastrophic things. What he predicted was rather there's an equilibrium which we're now roughly in, and we can never get much better than that. That's people usually misread that. He was wrong, because we know that from he wrote it 1800-something or other, and from then till now, standard of living have gone up enormously. So, where does this get into AI? Somebody made the argument that if you have human-level AI, since reproducing AI is essentially costless, because you're just copying a computer program, the AIs competing with both other AIs and humans for whatever forms of employment human-level intelligence can do will drive the wage down to the level at which AIs can just pay for their electricity, essentially. That's the argument. But the iron law, that's called the Silicon Law now, reappears with AIs. I think Robin Hanson is the one who originally made that argument. I'm not sure if it's right, but it's sort of an interesting and slightly scary argument because we're competing with them, right? We're human level eyes, if not AIs as well, so we're going to be really hungry in that world. Now, maybe the answer is yes, but in addition to labor, there's also capital and land. So maybe what happens is that we start out owning all the capital and land, and we end up living on our rents, even though our wages have gone to just enough to keep a computer program that can do the same work we're doing running. Because if they were more than that, he would make a copy of himself so they could get twice the wages. Anyway, it struck me as sort of a weird and interesting idea which ties together ideas from different times. All right, anything more people want to say on AI before we go on to VR? Gotta get this class over so that I can return to VR, because I'm sure I'll do something or other in World of Warcraft sometime this evening. All right, so for VR again, let's start by what were the things that struck you that you wanted to talk about, and then I've got a list of things we run out of things you want to talk about before we run out of time. I've got a list of things I can talk about. But,
can I ask a question really quick? I didn't quite understand what you're talking about, information transactions, material transactions in VR, whether obviously if you're in VR there's tons of information transaction, and is it possible, or were you thinking that you could also have material transactions?
No, what I'm saying is that in VR you can have the illusion of material transactions. Mm-hmm. In World of Warcraft you can produce food, you can cook in World of Warcraft, but that food is just information in a computer, it's not actually stuff you can eat.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the point I was trying to make is that there is a sense in which information transactions are just as real in virtual reality as in physical space. Or to put it differently, reading a book is already a virtual reality experience.
Yeah.
So it doesn't become less real if you read it on the computer instead of on paper. On the other hand, the food that you generate in a video game really is less real than the food you grow. It won't feed you. So that was a distinction I was trying to make, because one of the interesting sort of set of philosophical questions you touched on a little bit before in drug contexts and such, but that I think are brought out especially by VR of sort of what matters kinds of things. And my view, at least, is that real accomplishments matter and pretend accomplishments don't matter, or matter less. That I would rather have actually written a book full of clever ideas that 100,000 people read than merely have somebody use drugs or something else to make me believe I had written that book. I would rather looking at it now. On the other hand, I don't care whether I write a book that 100,000 people read in paper or whether I write a book that 100,000 people read on a computer screen, that the one is as real as the other. So the point, the distinction I was really trying to make was the sense in which VR is real for information transactions and is make-believe for real transactions. Does that make sense? I don't know if it makes sense or not. Other people? Other questions?
So have you talked about VR? I guess the biggest thing is The Matrix.
I have not seen the movie The Matrix. I have heard of the movie The Matrix. And that's one where people are living in an illusion.
Right.
And there's some crazy science fiction reason why they're being kept in the illusion, which from the description I've seen didn't sound very plausible. We're somehow providing fuel for something or other. I don't remember what from our minds. But
AI.
What?
I think they were providing fuel for AI. For the whole world has been taken over by robots.
Yeah, I don't see. Is it a good movie? But it does raise the whole issue of, you know, do you want to escape, so to speak? If
It is kind of like you were talking about mind drugs.
Yes. No, I agree. The philosophical issue, it seems to me, becomes more or less the same issue. Is what you really care about only stuff happening inside your head? Because if it's only stuff inside your head, then mind drugs that make you happy are as good as happiness from real accomplishment. Whereas if what I, before I get the mind run, say, I'm choosing a life for myself, I want a life where I really achieve things, then I'm saying that does count. And in just the same sense, if I have a choice between actually doing things in the real world or only having the illusion in virtual reality of doing things, does that matter? And I'm arguing that for certain kinds of things, it isn't an illusion, that if I make friends in virtual reality, if I make friends with another human being, which after all in a multiplayer game you can do, that's a real human, you know, interaction. They may not be a good one or a very rich one or whatever, but there's a real person I'm talking with. If I make friends with a NPC, a non-player character, on the other hand, that's just make-believe. All right. Putting it differently, one of the things that happened, you've seen World of Warcraft, and it makes a lot of sense in terms of what they're doing, is they're trying to give all the players status. So they're trying to make everybody feel like he's one of the most important people in that universe. And how do you do it? Well, you have the non-player characters in the game tell you, we've got to do this to save the world. And lo and behold, you do it. And boy, they say, aren't you wonderful, you've saved the world. That's not a real accomplishment. Although it's a game, you know, it's fun. It's just like watching a movie and being the hero or whatever. On the other hand, if what happens in the game is there's another person playing the game and you get an interesting conversation and maybe you do some of the things in the game together and you have, you know, the same feeling of accomplishment as if you'd won a football match or something, that's perfectly real. I mean, that's a, you know, you've demonstrated your skill, you've had the pleasure of teaming up with someone else and so forth. So those are some of the sorts of distinctions I'm trying to make, because I think they come up fairly clearly there. Other? Yeah.
But then in the distinction between non-playable characters and real people, the test of AI, the Alan Turing test of AI, where
you can't tell them apart.
Yeah, you ask.
I understand. And if the AI got good enough so that the non-player characters really were people, just computer people, suppose at the moment the non-player characters don't have any person. They're just a program. But suppose that program was running on the equivalent of the human brain, and the non-player character was actually a personality, just one that, well, at that point I'd have to say making friends with him and doing things with him is going to be like doing friends with any other person, right? If I haven't discussed with you the evidence that we're all non-player characters of that sort? Well, there's this wonderful argument that the philosophers usually put it in terms of the brain and a vat. All right, the philosopher's version of this argument is to say, look, how do you know that you are really the person you think you are sitting here with this body and not a brain in a vat in a lab somewhere, which is having signals fed into it, which create the illusion of what you're doing? And the computer person equivalent of that is, how do you know you aren't actually an artificial intelligence which has been designed to think it's a person and which is having stuff fed to it in its fictional world, just like you have pictures on the screen in World of Warcraft, so that this table isn't really here, but I think it's here because I get all the same sensations and my hand seems to stop. That's the philosophical question. And the interesting thing is the proof that, in fact, we are all AIs. And it's a very simple proof. It goes as follows. We start out by, proof is a little strong, let's say a convincing argument. We start out by assuming that technological progress is going to continue and economic growth is going to continue. And the result, if you run it through 1,000 years or something of exponential growth, is an immensely wealthy society. All right. And now, this society is presumably going to want entertainment, just as our society does. And the one obvious form of entertainment with its enormously greater resources and technological ability is going to be the equivalent of a novel, except that the characters are all AIs. So that you can, in effect, simulate some chunk of history and simulate it down to the neuron. All right? That's going to be much more interesting than just reading, you know, the paper-thin version of an ordinary novel. Well, the present time is clearly a particularly interesting time from the standpoint of 1,000 years from now, because this is when we're finally making the takeoff to high-tech, computer, AI, and all the rest of it. So surely, 1,000 years from now, people will be simulating this century thousands or millions of times over, each one with his own. All right. So you have no way of knowing whether you are a real person in the real version of the year 2012 or an AI in someone else's simulation of the year 2012. And if there are thousands of simulations and only one real history, what are the odds that you're in the real one? All right. Isn't that a beautiful argument? So we're all brains and bats. I will let you think about whether it's convincing or not, but I think it's at least beautiful. It at least satisfies my aesthetic.
So, and I think I'm real, no?
No, it doesn't tell you. That just means they've done decent programming, right? That's obviously the fact that you hurt when you pinch yourself is one of the things they're going to program into the AIs. Yep.
The follow-up question, though, is if you can't tell what differences make.
But that, in a certain sense, is part of the philosophical question I'm raising of whether it does matter. For example, suppose that you believe that you got drunk and killed a child driving in your car. If the child wasn't an AI, the child was just an illusion because that was part of the plot and they decided not to waste computing resources on that child, but you are, you shouldn't feel guilty. You didn't really hurt anybody. On the other hand, if you really squished a real child, you ought to feel guilty about it. All right, so that's an implication. Implication if you believe in sort of moral feelings and such, which most of us, whether or not we can justify it, do believe in.
In movies, you know, the way you distinguish an AI or non-real person, you know, that real person sweats.
Sweats?
Yeah.
Yeah, but of course, that's one of the things the AIs will think. The AI doesn't really sweat. The AI only thinks it sweats. You're not thinking of AI, you're thinking of robots.
Well, but I mean, AI for AI.
Who observes the... Who is it who is observing the AI sweat? Anything you observe can be rigged by the programmers, right?
Look at yourself in the mirror and after all the exercise and not sweating.
No, but you'll see the sweat. You're confusing robots. You're imagining that the AI is a robot functioning in the real world with a real mirror it can look into. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something where what you are is a piece of software running inside a computer. That real world isn't there. That there is a real world, but it's not the one you're seeing. The one you're seeing is just like World of Warcraft. It's one that the computer itself is constructing, telling you, you see a table here. The table isn't really there. Tell me when I hit my hand down, I feel the table. It isn't really there. Right? So, anyway.
You see the Matrix.
I should see the Matrix.
Movie, maybe
just
for like 20 minutes.
Maybe I should.
This is an amazing
movie. Yep.
Okay.
Look, I haven't even seen John Carter of Mars, and I want to see that one because I liked the books when I was much younger. What? Have any of you? It's a bad movie? That's too bad. Well, I've read the books already. There are a bunch of books. And then Burroughs was a really good storyteller with very little concern about plausibility. So does anybody, have you read the Burroughs books? Do you know why the Martians never invented parachutes? It's very simple. For those who haven't read the books or seen the movie, the Martians have these flying vehicles, which are like lighter than aircraft. They don't have to move in order to fly, but they use the fifth Barsoomian ray or something to hold them up. And they're flying around. So why haven't they invented a parachute? It's very simple. If you fall out of a Martian flying vehicle, there are only three things that can happen. The first thing that can happen is that by pure chance, there is another Martian flying vehicle immediately underneath, and you fall onto its deck. The second thing that can happen is that by pure chance, part of the leather harness that you've got your swords and guns hanging from catches on a protrusion of the ship you've just fallen out of, and you are hanging underneath the ship, listening to the bad guys plotting while you go along. And the third thing, least likely thing, is you fall to the Earth, or to the Mars rather, and you just happen to hit the only object on Mars soft enough to cushion your fall so you're not hurt. These are the only things that can happen to a Burroughs character when he falls out of an airship, so why invent a parachute? Right? Perfectly clear. Anyway, it's a lot of fun. When my younger son taught himself to read when he was about two, his sister was being taught how to read and he watched. And I then had the problem a few years later of what do you recommend to read to a, whatever he was, six-year-old with the reading ability of an adult and the taste of a six-year-old. And the Burroughs books were what I recommended. And he liked them, too. Though he still can't be seen the movie yet. Maybe we'll see it this summer when the kids are home. Any feeling on one of the questions that sort of comes up in the especially towards the end of the chapter is two very different ways of doing VR. The way I was originally imagining, which is the high-tech way, in which you actually fool the thing, and the way that people have been doing for thousands of years, which is the human imagination. So if you think about reading the Odyssey, there is a sense in which somebody reading or listening to originally, because it wasn't written, the Odyssey, is in a VR world, right? He's seeing all these impossible things happening. And my conclusion was that I had overestimated the advantages of the high tech, and my basis for that was that World of Warcraft took off. The World of Warcraft and its competitors involved many millions of people spending many hours a week. I don't know what the average player is, but I'm sure it's at least 5 hours a week, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was 25 hours a week, in a non-existent world, which feels real to them, and which matters to them, even though they know it's not real. And how does it do it? It uses a little technology, it uses a screen and a speaker, but the critical thing is that given the screen and the speaker give you the information you need, now your mind does the rest and makes you imagine it's real. And that I thought was sort of an interesting distinction. And I don't know whether when they really came across with the goggle hood fancy version, if I'd bother with it or not. Maybe not. After all, how will I be able to find my Diet Coke that's sitting on the desk next to the computer when I've got all that stuff on? Well, you're now at the deep VR stage, and I was stage. We've got three levels. We've got current off-the-shelf technology, which is computers, basically desktop computers or laptop computers. We've got the highest tech version that with our current technology and enough resources you could build. And that's the one where you've got goggles and the computer is setting up so as you turn your head you appear to be looking around things, and it's got good stereo sound, and maybe it's really fancy, it's got some way of synthesizing sound and feel, that's going to get harder. But you're, what? That's right, but you're in your present body, you're you, it's just that it's fooling you a lot. And then there's the really fancy version, which is what I call cracking the dreaming problem, and that's where we figure out how the mind works. You have a socket in the back of your neck. I don't know why it's the back of your neck, but that sort of is a standard place to put it. You plug in, and it's probably a wireless communication by then, and now you can have the illusion of anything at all. And all I was saying was that the second one, I'm not sure, was really better than the first if the first is combined with imagination. And that struck me as an interesting point. So what do you think? How many people here have spent a significant amount of time in some version of virtual reality entertainment more technological than a book or a movie? That is, have played computer games or... So probably... Boy, all these people who don't. You must get an awful lot done.
I just don't.
Yeah, you read novels instead or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's older version.
I just prefer my reality.
Yes, right. My daughter's term is mind games, for how you entertain yourself by thinking when you're otherwise doing it. Yeah? That's interesting. It's not the same kind of thing, but it certainly has a strong element of that. Yeah. Serving the web, though, is partly a way of actually learning about the real world. So in that way, it's a little bit like using a telescope.
You don't get addicted by absorbing the world without the internet. You get addicted by
serving the web. I'm not sure anymore. I'm not convinced I really understand what addiction means, other than people doing things so they like doing it. But So if somebody could provide you with the full version of the simulator, not the plug in the back of the neck yet one, but just the one where you've got goggles and everything else, would you bother with it, or is the screen a speaker and not good enough?
Interesting,
yeah. I don't know.
You mentioned that it makes me think about the difference between dreams and virtual reality.
Yes.
And they bring up movies again, but Inception feels very much like it's a movie about dreaming, and one of the things about creating, they actually hire people to create the world you dream in.
Uh-huh.
I mean, when you say, when you took the poll about spending time in virtual reality, I would say I'd probably spend more time, I'd probably spend just as much time dreaming.
Of course.
As some people spend.
And suppose you could control the dreams. Suppose, again, you've got the socket in the back of your neck, and a skilled artist, novelist type creates dreams, which are the equivalent of movies, except you're going to observe them as dreams. He creates lots of them. You can figure out which author you really like. now would do you think you would end up with that absorbing most of your time? Would that end up sort of you know, make enough money to stay alive and you spend all of your time in dreams?
Yeah. That's precisely what they point out. It's like a 30-second ode in the movie to some people, but they do it chemically. I don't know how they manufacture the world that people are dreaming in. But they chemically induce some sort of sleep to get you to that REM state and then keep you there. And some people, I guess, choose to stay there for, you know, like 23 hours of the day.
So let's take the people here. Suppose that we've got the technology. This is the high level AI, VR technology now. So that you can be fed the illusion of any experience, any set of experiences, including both recordings by people and fictionally created ones, the equivalent of a movie or a novel, but a full-sense movie novel. How many people think that that would end up absorbing most of the time that they didn't actually need to stay alive?
Can I ask a follow-up question on that? Can we control, like dreams sometimes you can't.
Yes, that's a good question.
Games, you can't control. So dreams, I would say, if it's a dream-like setting where I can't control, I would say no, because sometimes there's nightmares.
Well, but no, but this is the one where you have to choose your author. That
okay.
is, you can't control it, just as you can't control the novel you're reading or the movie you're seeing.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, there have been novels I've stopped reading because I can't control it and it's getting dark. The author of one such novel, somebody I happen to know, when I commented that I had I had dropped out of one or two of his books for that reason, and his reply was, yes, he can write things darker than he can read. And you're going to sense see why, because when you're writing, you're controlling it. So he may know that ultimately the bad things aren't going to happen, but I, as the reader, don't know that, and therefore don't want to put myself at risk, as it were. But it seems to me that your controlling is getting more closer to what I think is my standard strong VR story, which is the one where you have the imaginary mansion on the Pacific coast, and you can have the best ice cream in the world and no calories because you're really just thinking you're eating it and so forth. And that, it seems to me, is closer. Isn't that more your controlled dream or not?
Well, when you say, like, you're picking the author, you're picking the theme, it's like, I enjoy movies that have suspense. And, you know, so that's a theme, that's a genre.
And you can't control
them. There, and I can't control them. I enjoy them.
Would you still enjoy it if it had the full sense effect of a dream?
No. I think I wouldn't want that.
That gets too scary. Yeah. Unless you really trust the author.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have the same problem. It's a control issue. Just like I feel like I have the choice, I have the control. I can't have somebody else manipulating me into doing things.
But when you read a novel, you have no choice. You're identifying with the protagonist.
It's a big difference because when I'm reading a novel, I know clearly what I'm reading is fiction, where I am is real. But if I become part of it,
This is becoming a different question, which I was also going to ask. Do you want to know that it's not real when it's happening? Let's imagine the case where a good artist, a good author writes a story, and because this is dreaming technology, you actually are a character in the story having things happen to you. And we've got two versions of it. In version A, you're also you. You know you're also you, even though you're not paying much attention to that. It's just like watching a movie, except it's the movie in full sense. Version B, while it's happening, it's real to you. And only when it's over do you wake up and say, aha, which is what happens in dreams, after all. Right? Dreams, while they're happening, you sometimes you know it's a dream, but usually, I think, in a dream, what's happening, you believe in it. Which would you choose?
That's just like sitting in a roller coaster. One of them, yeah, you have control and somebody else has your destiny. But no way.
So
I want to know that.
So your feeling is that you want the version where you're watching it but you're not believing in it.
Right.
Anybody who's willing to take the opposite side? Any brave people who would want the...
I'm too low to sit on a roller coaster and let somebody else control my ride.
But...
What do you believe what's going on?
While it's happening. What?
I feel like I would take that one. I don't know. It would be less control.
It's not only less control. It's going to be much, much more vivid. Imagine for a moment that the movie is about a war scene.
No way.
looking afterwards, looking back after it's over, having in my memory, having been in through the experience of, my God, I could get killed, but I'm a brave man, and you know, I'm going to take the risk, and so forth. That's going to be a much more exciting memory than the memory of watching the illusion of it when I knew perfectly well. I mean, I can't really hurt in this. I mean,
that's like a nightmare.
You can go do what you want down to the movie theaters for $10, you know. What he's describing is a very absorbing experience.
But I have to know the full script. If I know the full script,
you can't know the full script once you're seeing it, because if you're absorbed, you don't know that it's a script. But you can imagine a case where before you turn it on, you get to read a script summary. And then when you turn it on, for the moment that vanishes because you're not you anymore. You're the character in the story at that point.
If I know the script.
And before you go in, you get to choose the script.
How long is it? 10 minutes.
Yeah, but what? How about half an hour?
If I know the script, that's the script I'm going to agree to, and then...
One reason why I had a question about the material transaction, information transaction, is because there are some things that we see and we hear that cause physical reactions.
Yes.
So I might sign up for something that, say, monitored my heart rate and maybe, like, the other chemicals that indicate emotion.
Yeah.
And I might sign up to a script that says, okay, when heart rate is getting to this point and starts to sweating, let's change the storyline a little bit. I don't know if that's possible, but something I could
Or just terminate it, just wake up at that point.
Yeah, just, you know, if it's really bad, wake up, or, you know, let me press a back button, you know, take me back to scene one, and, you know, not take me down like the dark ceiling.
Yeah, you could imagine a lot of those sorts of things.
See, that's all about control, right? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, but...
It's a little bit less control, though.
That means that either you know how to press a button...
No, but in your version, you aren't controlling it, right? Yeah. It's a computer program which is controlling it. It's just you told in advance when you want out.
Yeah, I like put my life in the hand of the computer, sure thing, so whatever.
And it's based on physiological response, so it's not a total... like knowing the script and
interpreting. Yes. Yes. So other people with opinions, in between these, the two alternatives, it's really just the movie slightly improved or the one that feels real while it's happening. Let me go on to then some other questions associated with all of this. One of them was one which I discussed there, probably because I actually had a little bit of evidence, is what's the effect on the real world of the existence of good VR? So the particular example that I'm raising is, does the ability to do certain bad things fictionally cause you to be more or less likely to do them, cause people to be more or less likely to do them in the real world? So if you imagine, and I went back, the Orwell, Orwell has this review of what sounds like a pretty dreadful American thriller, which is sort of full of sex sadism kind of stuff. This is from 1930s or 40s, something a long time ago. And he found it a pretty repulsive book, but in particular he was worried that reading books like that would coarsen the people. That people read the book, they're imagining being the character, and they say, all right, beating up people is just fine. And torturing people and whatever bad things are happening in this. And you see that same argument, I think, in many different contexts of people... What? Video games, television, does California now have a law against violent video games? Somebody was proposing one, at least, at one point.
They got shut down in Western court.
Yes. And, but television, that argument certainly got made as well. As I say, I've got a little bit of data on the pornography case, because somebody did do what struck me as quite a clever, simple study to find out whether, and which it did. Do people have opinions sort of subjectively? Are you likely, if you've been reading a bunch of spy novels where the good guy murders people, or maybe where the good guy even tortures bad people to find out where the hidden atomic bomb is that's going to take out New York or something, after doing that, do you think you're more likely to actually use those things? Yeah.
I don't know if anyone in here is overplaying Grand Theft Auto. It's a very mild game.
Yeah, I don't know. Never played it.
Yeah, you're just a criminal. And I know if you play that, or I've only played it a couple times, it was for extended periods of time, and then you walk out the street and the world is Grand Theft Auto to you, I swear. And I mean, I've never acted on any of that, but you really do view the world in a warped way after that, something like that. At least I feel like I did anyway.
And can you describe that warped view? What are you more or less likely to do? Is it just that you're more likely to dodge if you hear a loud noise?
I don't think it's that. I think that you view it from the point of view, it's like, well, in this video game, I guess I would have gone with my bat and shattered that window and took this car to wherever I was going, right? You know, you wouldn't actually act on that if you are viewing the world as those are options right now. Not something you would necessarily exercise, but where it wasn't an option before, it suddenly is.
Interesting.
Yeah, driving around. It's just that mind. I'm talking about the same video game, but driving around, you might see, you know, a certain configuration of model. Hey, that could be a ramp. I could speed up and jump right off of it. You know, I would never do that. But your brain starts thinking that way, right?
You have different options.
Yeah.
When it flies up, it's not yet time to pull over.
What?
your hood flies up, you don't even pull over.
The thing is, not everybody gets affected the same, right? So there's,
yes.
I assume there's a bell curve where you've got these extremes. So most people can differentiate between the virtual reality and the real life, but
part of what I'm curious about is the sign of the effect, because the way I put it as an economist is, are these complements or substitutes? Is that having had the experience of beating people up in a video game, you now no longer want to beat people in the real world. You know, I've done all that, and you know, you get hurt at beating people up, and I don't need the thrill anymore. I really am feeling aggressive. Fine, I'll go back and play the video game again. Or is it that having beaten people up in a video game, you now, it now seems more normal to beat people up, and so you're willing to do it in the real world?
I can say from my personal experience, one time I was playing a video game for long enough that everybody wanted to beat me up because for some reason I was winning, and that never happens. But I think it does, in all seriousness, it does make people more aggressive toward each other on a small level because it incites that competition. I don't know if that necessarily translates to violence, but it certainly translates.
It incites the competition. Are you talking about playing a game against somebody else or just playing a game by yourself and where you're competing with the computer?
I think both, because you're always in that state of adversarial competition.
Because I could see that playing against somebody else, just like playing tennis against somebody else, might make you feel aggressive. It doesn't have to if people are different. And I'm not sure if the same thing would be true if you were playing essentially a very fancy version of solitaire, which is what one-person computer games really are. Let me mention one other thing, which I was just thinking is sort of interesting. I discussed at some point back Robert Nozick's experience machine hypothetical. Nozick, for those who don't know, was a Harvard philosopher who was a fairly prominent figure. And there's another bit of Nozick's famous book, which is called Anarchy, State, and Utopia, which is also relevant to VR in a different way. And that's the final section of the book, is his idea of utopia. And his idea of utopia is not a society. It's a world of societies. His idea of utopia is a world where somewhere there is a place where no one is allowed to curse, and they can't use dirty language, and everybody being loved. You don't have to go there. But the people who want to live in that society have that option. And over there, there's the society where it's perfectly legitimate to beat up anybody you want. Of course, you might get beaten up as well. Only people who are there are the people who want to live in that kind of violent place. And everything in between. So you got those, obviously, have lots of other dimensions. And so that's sort of a neat, interesting idea. And one of the things that struck me thinking about VR is that things like World of Warcraft really give you something pretty close to the option of Nozick's utopia. Because if there are people who want to live in a world where everybody is sort of very polite and courteous and sort of the way we imagine maybe China, Japan to have been at one point or something like that, someone will create a computer game in which that's how you interact in that game. And if you want one, you take a very simple case, as you may know in World of Warcraft, some servers are what are called PvP servers, which means that your character can attack other characters more or less under any circumstances. And then the non-PvP ones, you can only fight other characters under certain very restricted circumstances. Some people like one, people like the other. So one of the neat thoughts is that you could have in the fairly near future a situation where for a lot of your time, all the time that's sitting looking at a computer screen, you can pick the environment, the society that you want to be in. Yes?
Isn't that kind of like a metaphor for what we have now with different countries where you choose a different lifestyle and you seek a different opportunity? I mean, it's a lot harder to transition from one to the other, but the idea is the same of like you want to choose a different world where people treat each other differently.
Voting with your feet. But yes, no, it's a whole lot harder. First, the range is very limited, especially if you only speak one language. And the actual moving is much harder. And he wanted sort of the complete range and easy moving. And what I'm saying is there's a sense in which you will get much closer to that. Just with the kind of VR that's already happening, which seems to be sort of interesting. Alright, I think we're out of time. I get to go home and do some VR. As do any of you who don't have too much work to do.
Is it deep VR? What? Do
you do deep VR? Or no, not yet. Next year they'll have that.
There was the issue of, you know, having lag time, right? So, if you were to consider a scenario where you could possibly have multiple different artificial, well, copies of yourself, you have multiple copies of the new numbers, and potentially, like, tolerate that lag of, like, 10 minutes, 20 minutes from here to here, or wherever you are in the mission, by having artificial, you know, like a cyborg type thing, or whatever.
Oh, you want a ship.
Yeah, and then...
So the ship's got a pilot, it's just the pilot doesn't have flesh.
Yeah, but the pilot doesn't have flesh, yeah, and no one wants to tolerate that. Your trip to